So yeah, anyway, welcome to Cosmology. So I'm Matt Johnson. That's Juan Cayuso, who just walked in. He's the TA for the course. The fellow is Gazal Gesnejani. So you'll see Juan and Gazal at the tutorials, and they'll also run an office hour that will be available for you guys to ask questions. Yeah, so you're here, so you know when the lecture is. 1 o'clock, Tuesday, Thursday. Show of hands, I know there's something right after this. How many of you go to that right after this? Okay, so I will give you 10 minutes before you have to go to that so you can like take a little decompression break. So yeah, 2:30 means 2:20 then, and I will try and respect that. And if I don't, just like raise your hand and be like, I'd like to go get a glass of water before the next thing, please stop. So then there will also be tutorials. So here are the dates for the tutorials. The course will be split into two parts. So for those of you in Psi, you're welcome to take part one and not part two. If you are a PhD student, then you have to take part one and part two. So I guess that's Eli and whoever is joining on the Zoom. So yeah, the tutorials will be at 2:30, February 18th, 27, March 5th. March 12, 17, 24, 31 at 3. And then here are the office hours. So basically it will alternate. Like this week there's no tutorial, but there will be an office hour. Next week there will be a tutorial and an office hour, and then it should be a tutorial and an office hour, kind of following that every week, Tuesday and Thursday. Yeah, so that covers that. Those of you in Psi have access to the wiki. Eli, do you have access to the Psi wiki? No, so we need to work on that for you, and the York students, we need to work on that for you. But on the wiki right now, you'll find the course syllabus with all those dates, so you don't need to write them down. Eli, don't leave before you give me your email address, and then I'll give that to you so you have it. Also, on the Psi wiki, you'll find right after the lecture, some notes. So I'll try and distribute these notes before the lecture, and it will just outline the stuff that we're gonna cover in the lecture. I hope that it's pretty self-contained and that these will be a good resource such that you don't necessarily need a textbook. However, it's probably also helpful to take a look and find your favorite cosmology textbook, which will be more comprehensive than my notes. So I put some suggestions on the syllabus. I really like Modern Cosmology by Scott Dottelson. There's also a book by Mukhanov that's really good. Hebel's that's really good. There's lots of really good books, and they're all in the library. So you can go just look at cosmology textbooks in the library and find your favorite one. And that could be an extra resource for you. But like I said, hopefully the notes cover everything that I actually talk about. Okay. So here's a bit of the plan of where I hope we can go. So part one will kind of roughly speaking be about the homogeneous universe. And part two, roughly speaking, will be about the inhomogeneous universe. So hopefully in part one, which will be the first 4 weeks, we're gonna get on the same page with GR. I'll just do a brief review. We'll talk about Friedman-Robertson-Walker universes, how we measure distances, some basics about statistics so that we can talk about data. We'll talk about Big Bang nucleosynthesis, recombination and dark matter, and then we'll end by talking about the early universe and the theory of inflation. And then in part two, it's basically all about cosmological perturbation theory, which is the study of the growth of density fluctuations in the universe into galaxies and stars and us. So we'll talk about the formal theory of cosmological perturbation theory, which is basically linearized general relativity, the growth of structure, and then the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is one of the best tools we have to learn about cosmology. And then we'll talk about inflation again, but we'll study the quantum mechanical seeds for structure that are predicted to come from inflation. Okay, so that's our plan. I hope we can get all the way there. Let's see. There will be two homework assignments for each part. Your first one I'll have ready by Thursday for you to have beginning of class. And that's basically the plan. So any questions about the logistics before we dive right in? Okay, then let's dive right in. So I thought I'd start by telling you why I think cosmology is a really interesting subject, and just sort of big picture stuff. Okay, so what is cosmology? Well, first I'll talk about what knowledge it requires or what different pieces of physics that we use. So general relativity is kind of the language in which we phrase cosmology. You have to know a lot about atomic physics. So the atoms that inhabit the universe can absorb and emit light, and we observe light, so got to understand that. Statistics, if we want to quantify our theory of cosmology, which is largely a statistical theory, we make statistical predictions for what we observe, not that there is a galaxy exactly at that spot in the universe. We don't care so much about that, but more the distribution, the statistics of galaxies, for example. Speaking of galaxies, you got to know a lot about astronomy and astrophysics. Got to know about nuclear physics because, well, all the elements we think were basically birthed in the early universe. So if you want to understand where you come from, hydrogen and the sun comes from, helium, why is there the fractions that there are, then you better understand nuclear physics. Statistical mechanics, hot stuff, hot gases, universe is full of radiation and matter. How do we describe the statistical mechanics? Particle physics, what are the things that we find in the universe? Standard model particles, dark matter, beyond the standard model, all sorts of things there. We observe light, so you better include electricity and magnetism. Eventually, if we go back enough in time, the universe gets really hot and dense, and then we think there's a singularity. We don't understand what general relativity does there, so you better understand quantum gravity or have some idea about what might happen. Okay, and like all of this is contained within cosmology. And so I think it's really cool to study cosmology because it forces you to know a lot about a lot of stuff. And it also lets you make contact with lots of different kinds of physics. So for example, the things we learn in cosmology can inform what we think about particle physics. It can provide great precision tests of what we think about nuclear physics, and so on and so forth. So it's sort of a bit of everything. And I think that's really interesting. So what is the goal of cosmology? So basically, you want to learn about the history composition and the future of our universe. And the way we do this is kind of like as historians. So this is all based on sort of imperfect records of the past. And why of the past? Because light travels at a finite speed, and so the stuff that we see out there is actually old, right? We see it as it was billions of years ago. So we get these sort of imperfect records, and we're supposed to like use them to infer what happens, what the universe is made of, how it's going to evolve in the future, and so on and so forth. So it's almost a historical science. And the probably the biggest part of this goal is that cosmology can inform us about new physics. I mean, most of the new physics that we think is out there beyond the standard model of particle physics, most of the evidence for that actually comes from cosmology. So, dark matter. Dark energy, the stuff we think that's causing the universe to undergo accelerated expansion. Quantum gravity. We think the Big Bang is the only place where we actually have access to the scales associated with quantum gravity, because in black holes, unfortunately, they're stuck behind event horizons. Okay, so cosmology has the potential to inform us about this new physics. And there are, you know, maybe other things like new particles. Attend some particle physics seminars and you'll see that every single one of them has to do with cosmology now. Okay, because any new particles you invent to solve any problem with the standard model, like the hierarchy problem, or to be a dark matter candidate, or to have something to do with the early universe, all those things make connection with cosmology. So kind of broadly speaking, you know, that's like a big picture of what is cosmology. Okay, so how do we actually do cosmology? What do we observe? So one thing we can do is measure the redshifting of light. So if we know hydrogen atoms emit light at a certain frequency, and we observe the shifted spectrum of hydrogen, we can measure that shift, and that's the redshift. So that's a proxy for distance. Okay, so redshift is like a measure of distance. There are things called standard candles. These are objects of known luminosity. We measure their flux, and therefore we can infer their distance. So again, that's a proxy for distance. There's standard rulers. These are things that we know how big they should be in physical space. And so if we observe their angular size, we can infer how far they are away. So again, that's another proxy for distance. People measure the age of stars based on how we understand that they burn elements and how much of what proportion of those elements we see in their atmosphere. And so you can get an estimate of like how old is the universe based on the oldest stars. So again, I'd say that this is like a proxy for distance, if I get to divide by the speed of light, okay, it's a scale. Maybe that one's got a little bit of artistic license, but anyway, it kind of fits with these ones best. And then there's other things we can observe. So you can measure like the number of objects or the number per unit area of objects, like a number density. So I could just like count how many galaxies are over there, how many are over there. Or you could look at like the varying intensity of emission or absorption. So, you know, you might have clouds of hydrogen that emit light or absorb light. And so based on the intensity of that emission or absorption, you can get an idea of how much stuff there is there. Okay, so these are all things that trace structure, right? So they trace where the galaxies are, where the gas are, so on and so forth. And then, of course, there's the cosmic microwave background radiation. And that actually traces structure and it's also a proxy for distance. And we could go on and like put a few more things on the board, but I hope you get the point that the basic things that we observe in cosmology are distances and the distribution of structure, right? So those are the observables. And instead of distance, let's say we call that geometry. So distances and time. And the distribution of structure. Okay, so those are the basic things that we observe in cosmology. And of course, we should have theories that predict those things that we observe, right? So theoretical cosmology is basically around to make predictions for this stuff based on all of this physics that we have over here. All right. So, of course, we have already, you know, well, first of all, cosmology has come a really long way because it hasn't really been able to do this until maybe 30 years ago. So it's quite a new subject, relatively speaking. And the reason it is a new subject is because all of these observations over here were relatively difficult, and it took us a while to do that. So it wasn't really necessary to have very concrete theory, because basically any theory predicted what we observe. So until we observed things very carefully, we didn't have to be very careful about our theories. But now we have observed things extremely carefully, and we are in a situation where instead of a lot of theories that can explain what we observe, we got a lot of observations and really no theories. Which is great news for you guys, theoretical physicists, yeah? Okay. But you know, that being said, we do have a standard model of cosmology that does a pretty darn good job of explaining almost all those things we observe. Most of those goals here in part one and part two are basically to explain this, okay? So you could rephrase the goal of our course as basically understanding the standard cosmological model and where the holes in it are and what the successes of it are to hopefully inspire and motivate you to fix those holes and find what's beyond it. So the standard cosmological model's got a name. It's called Lambda CDM. And I'm going to be really controversial and put I here. Controversial for the Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics. So lambda stands for an element of the standard cosmological model. Has a cosmological constant. I'm sure you've heard the universe is undergoing accelerated expansion. That is why we think it is accelerating. Okay, CDM stands for cold, dark matter. Okay, this is the stuff that's like the glue that holds structures together. So if we didn't have this piece, then the universe, the structures in the universe would not look anything like they actually do. And this I stands for inflation, which is not really a theory and more like a paradigm, but currently it's kind of the best idea we have for what set up the initial conditions for our observable universe. Okay, so this model basically has got 6 parameters. So these are 6 numbers that need to be determined by these experiments, or these observations. And once you fix those 6 parameters, plus including all of the standard physics over here, you can predict everything we observe. And there's really no evidence that you need to go beyond these 6 parameters, at least not very statistically compelling evidence that you need to go beyond these 6 parameters. So one parameterization of these 6 is the amount of dark matter and the amount of atomic matter, which is usually called baryons. Baryons just means anything that's not dark matter. Something called the Hubble constant, which tells you how distances behave in the nearby universe. We'll talk about all this, but roughly speaking, this is the geometry part. Okay. And the words that go with the geometry part of the standard cosmological model, which again, we'll spend the majority of part one trying to understand what they mean, is that our universe is spatially flat, homogeneous, isotropic, and expanding. And now it's undergoing accelerated expansion. Okay. So those are the words that go with the geometry. And that can be subsumed into 3 numbers plus physics. Okay, so those 3. There's 2 more numbers that have to do with the initial conditions and structure. Okay, so the universe is not totally homogeneous, that is the same everywhere. It's lumpy. The evidence of that is us sitting here. We're not like a smooth uniform gas of blobs learning about stuff. We're people, live on the Earth. The Earth is in the solar system, in the Milky Way galaxy, and so on and so forth. So there's like interesting structure. So we should understand where that came from. And that structure in the universe, we think, can be described by basically these 2 numbers plus the geometry. These ones we're already done with. And the words that go with structure, this piece of the standard cosmological model, is that these structures are formed from adiabatic, Gaussian, nearly scale invariant, initially tiny, that one's not a technical term, density fluctuations. And more or less, most of part 2 is going to be about understanding what all those words mean and where they come from and why those assumptions are there. Is there a question?
Are all these words for like geometry and structure all for the observable universe, or is it predicting the universe, whatever is outside also?
Excellent question. So do these things predict, for example, stuff that we don't directly observe? And the answer is yes, they do. However, I could not tell you if that is correct or not. So does the universe end exactly past the point which we can see? Probably not. And certainly the basic theory doesn't predict that it does, but I don't know. I couldn't tell you because I can't observe that. So if you want to be a minimalist, yeah, you just predict things for what we see. And then there's all sorts of extremely interesting discussions about the stuff we can't directly see. And so we can infer things about that. In fact, a lot of the stuff we'll talk about is inferred. Like the CMB is basically the cloud deck of the universe because light cannot penetrate past this time, 380,000 years after the Big Bang. We'll talk about that later more. But just take that now as a given. Yeah, and so anything that is older than that is totally inferred. Because we take the stuff we actually observe, which is this cloud deck, and then we say, what's beyond that? And we use this physics that we think we understand to infer what happens. So like BBN, that's inferred. We look at the distribution of elements that we see today and we say, well, how could that have gotten there based on this physics? Inflation, that's inferred. We see these fluctuations described by these words and we ask, how could they have gotten there? And that's totally inferred. It's not directly observed. So anyway, that's a long-winded answer to your question. Yeah. We do talk about stuff we don't directly see. I guess that's the short answer to your question. And then there's one more parameter called tau, the optical depth. And this one is kind of special. I would call that astrophysics, actually. This is basically how transparent is the universe? Because we observe most things with light, it's nice to know how transparent the universe is. Okay. And so the word that goes with this is, well, mostly transparent until the CMB was formed. And we'll talk more about that later. Right. So the standard cosmological model can be described by these six parameters, this set of words, and all that physics. And hopefully, like 9 weeks from now, that's all child's play. You understand it. Okay. So now let's get to doing something. Let's start with the most basic observation that you can all make about the universe, which is that if you go outside tonight and there's no clouds and you look up at the night sky, it's pretty dark. That's actually quite a profound observation, which can teach us a lot about the universe. Just in and of itself by working through the assumptions that I need to have for that to be true. And so along the way, I'm gonna use this digression as an excuse to introduce you to units. You're theoretical physicists, but sorry, like we'll have to use units and that will be important to understand some basic dimensionful quantities. We'll talk about the distribution of stuff in the universe and, well, some other kind of basic things. Okay. So let's start with the most basic observation. So the sky is mostly dark, and if we are in the city at least, and I can't really distinguish the Milky Way galaxy, it looks pretty much the same everywhere. Just like interesting constellations and whatnot, but yeah, it looks pretty same, okay? The sky is mostly dark and looks the same in all directions. Okay, so this piece here is sort of the basis for an assumption. That this implies that the universe is homogeneous, means same everywhere. That implies that physics is the same everywhere. That implies that, at least statistically, the distribution of stuff is the same everywhere, and that we inhabit like a pretty representative place. We don't live in a very special place. And isotropic. So that's kind of more tied to what we actually directly observe, which is that if we observe the universe at different places on the sky, it looks pretty much the same. Okay. So same from any angle. So. Okay, so let's work with that assumption. And let me just give you a laundry list of numbers that you should memorize, dimensionful numbers that you should memorize. Okay, okay, so how is stuff in the universe arranged? Let's say this is the sun. Here's a star. How far away is that star? Closest star is like a parsec away. Parsec is like 3 light years, okay? To put it in a unit that maybe you're more familiar with. So the characteristic distance between stars is like a parsec in a galaxy. So our sun is in the Milky Way galaxy. And the characteristic size, well, the distance from our sun to the center of our galaxy is like 10 kiloparsecs. So let's take that as a representative size of galaxies. Okay, so that's like 10,000 parsecs or 30,000 light years, okay? There's other galaxies in the universe, right? So this is like the Andromeda Galaxy, for example. And if we ask how far away is the Andromeda Galaxy from the Milky Way, that's about a megaparsec, 1 million parsecs, 3 million light years, okay? And the Milky Way and Andromeda are part of a galaxy cluster, okay? And the typical size of a galaxy cluster is like 10 megaparsecs. So let's say that this structure is like 10 megaparsecs. Okay. And in terms of structures, a galaxy cluster, a really big galaxy cluster, is about as big as structures get. Okay. But there are multiple of them. So we should also want to know like how far apart are galaxy clusters. And I've run out of board space, so I have to draw galaxy clusters on the next board. So the distance between galaxy clusters is something between 10 and 100 megaparsecs, okay? And there aren't really structures bigger than that, okay? So you can think of like, if we have a really big universe, it's full of these objects, galaxy clusters, that are made of smaller objects, galaxies, that are made of smaller objects, stars, okay? And that's kind of the hierarchy of the universe, okay? That's a really important feature of the universe we'll talk a lot about in part 2. But you know, the universe isn't like a homogeneous distribution of stars. It's big structures with in full of denser structures, full of denser structures, and it, you know, to us. Okay. So that's like the distribution of stuff. And now let's see where we can go with this. So when I said the universe was homogeneous and isotropic, the scale on which we can really say it looks the same everywhere, really, because in this room it doesn't look the same everywhere, and in the solar system it doesn't look the same everywhere, but on scales bigger than this, it does. Okay, and that's just an empirical fact about our universe. So on scales above like 100 megaparsecs, the universe looks pretty homogeneous and isotropic. Let's just remember that. That's a really important number to memorize. So just remember, like 100 megaparsecs is a really important number. Okay, good. So the next thing I want to do is let's have an exercise and let's count all the stars. And let's start with the smallest structure that is a collection of stars, a galaxy. Okay, so how many stars are there in a galaxy? Okay, so we're going to estimate the number of stars basically as the size of the Milky Way galaxy cubed. So let's make it a spherical cow, and the Milky Way galaxy is a big sphere, divided by the characteristic distance between stars. Okay, so the number we're going to say is something like 10 kiloparsecs cubed divided by a parsec cubed. Okay, so 10 kiloparsecs is 10 to the fourth parsecs, and that means that this is about 10 to the 12th. Okay. So a rough guess of how many stars there are in a galaxy is about 10 to the 12th, a trillion. A trillion is also a really important number to remember, because it turns out the answer to every question in cosmology about the number of things is a trillion. There's a trillion galaxies in the universe, and there's a trillion stars in the Milky Way. So another kind of number to keep in the back of your head. Okay, so that's the number of stars. We could also estimate the density of stars in the Milky Way if we assume that every single star is just like our sun. Then the density, since the distance between stars is one parsec, is like one solar mass per parsec cubed. Question?
Yeah. When we talk about the size of a galaxy, it's whatever observable matter is inside, right? We say cold, the dark matter is.
We are so not that fine-grained picture. Forget about those things. It's like really just order of magnitude. How far away is the Earth from the center of the galaxy? And then take that as a representative scale of a galaxy. But you're right. And of course, every galaxy will have a different size. And then there's a distinction between where the stars are and where the dark matter is, and all those things, all those complications. But right now, it's the spherical cow. Yeah. Okay, so that's a galaxy. It's like 10 to the 12 stars, and the density, the mass density is like a solar mass per cubic parsec. So then we could talk about a cluster of galaxies. So first, We could estimate the number of galaxies in a cluster of galaxies, right? And we do the same thing. So it's like the size of a cluster cubed divided by the characteristic distance between galaxies in a cluster cubed. So that's 10 megaparsecs cubed over 1 megaparsec. In other words, about 1,000. Okay, so then the number of stars in a cluster of galaxies is the number of stars we estimated per galaxy times the number of galaxies. So roughly 10 to the 3 times 10 to the 12, like 10 to the 15. Okay. So there's like 10 to the 15 stars in a cluster. Again, we could calculate the density in a cluster. So we take the number of stars, 10 to the 15. We say that they're all like the sun, so they weigh one solar mass. And then we divide by the size of the cluster cubed, 10 megaparsecs cubed. Megaparsec is 10 to the 6th parsec. So if we go back to the units of parsecs, then this thing is like 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per cubic parsec. Okay. So on average, the mass density of a cluster of galaxies is like 1,000,000 times smaller than the mass density of a galaxy. Very important feature of hierarchical structures in the universe. The smaller the structure, the more dense it is. Okay? So galaxies are far more dense than clusters of galaxies. Okay. So now we could look at the ambient universe . So we haven't talked yet about how big the universe is, but we could talk about densities because we kind of know that the biggest structure are these clusters. We kind of know how far apart they are, so we could ask like about what is the mean density in the universe. And we could estimate that by saying, well, there's 10 to the 15 solar masses in clusters of galaxies, and they're about 10 to 100 megaparsecs apart. So let's divide this by between 10 and 100 megaparsecs cubed. So if we do this, we get something between 10 to the 9, 10 to the minus 9, and 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per cubic parsec. And the measured value is more like 10 to the minus 7. Like that. Okay, so this stupid order of magnitude estimate is because it's got such a big range, not too far off. So that's like the mean density of mass in the universe. It's this. So just as a brief aside, I can now define what we mean by structure and why is it that clusters of galaxies are the biggest structures in the universe. So if we define the overdensity as the density minus the mean density of the universe divided by the mean density of the universe, okay? Then a structure means that this is bigger than or equal to 1. In other words, if I had like a uniform distribution of stuff and I had something that was twice as dense as the mean, then we would say that that is a structure. And if it's not, then it kind of just blends in. Okay. So with that definition, you could look at a galaxy using these kind of order of magnitude estimates again. So for a galaxy, delta is like 10 to the 7. For a cluster, it's a million times smaller, so like 10. Yeah. And there are objects called superclusters, which are like just a little bit bigger structures. Yeah. And those would have delta of order 1. Okay, so that would be like a few clusters in a region, say they're almost 10 megaparsecs apart. Okay. So clusters are kind of the biggest structure, because if I made something bigger, the density would just be too small to call it a structure. And when things are this overdense, and then another thing that happens is that gravity can work. So gravity can hold them together against the expansion of the universe. We'll talk about that too, of course, eventually. All right. Okay. So we did this counting exercise, and now we can go back to our basic observation that the sky looks mostly dark. And we can ask, given what I've just told you about the distribution of stuff in the universe and how many stars there are and what their density is, how do we connect that to this basic observation? Okay. So let's look at the average density of stars in the universe. The average density of stars is this, right? So 10 to the minus 7 per cubic parsec. So I have to make a box that big to find a star on average. Okay, and let's just imagine for the moment that stars are uniformly distributed. Right? And if I look on large enough scales, they are more or less uniformly distributed. Okay, so if they're all like the sun, then we can guess what their size is. So the radius of the sun in the units that we're using here, which are kind of not the great units for the radius of the sun, but in parsecs, like 10 to the minus 8 parsecs. The luminosity of the sun. We could say that the luminosity of stars is the same as the luminosity of the sun. That's like 10 to the 26 watts. And now is our model of the night sky. Let's imagine we've got a bunch of stars kind of uniformly filling space. Here we are on the Earth. We look out. Okay. Let's approximate a line of sight, the direction that we're looking on the sky, as a cylinder. Okay. So if we look out on the night sky, then the size of the sky that's blocked out by a star, right? The size of this cylinder in physical space is just, well, the area of that star on the sky, right? And let's say that the length of this cylinder, that's just the distance to the star, lambda. Okay. And if I picked a random place on the sky, we could calculate the probability that there's a star filling that pencil beam. Okay. And the probability is just given by the number density of stars, okay, which we approximate over here, assuming they're all uniformly filling the universe, multiplied by the volume of this tube. Okay, so that's just the area times lambda. Okay, so the surprising implication is that, well, if I picked a random place on the sky and I let my tube get infinitely big, then there is going to be order, well, there will be a probability of one that in any direction I will see a star, right? It doesn't have to be infinitely big. In fact, we can calculate how far out I need to go for the probability to be one. So we just solve for lambda. So lambda is 1 over n pi r star squared. And if we stick in the numbers that we have over there, well, that's in twiddles, 10 to the 7 parsec cubed times 10 to the 8 parsec squared to the minus 2, excuse me. And that is like 10 to the 23 parsecs, or 10 to the 17 megaparsecs. So if the size of the universe was 10 to the 17 megaparsecs, then there would be an order one probability that everywhere I look on the sky, there's a star. So that's what this is saying. Okay, so what? Like, what if that was true? I mean, after all, like, most of these stars are going to be really far away, and because they're really far away, they're going to be really dim. So would I notice? So to determine if we would notice, let's calculate how bright would the night sky be if the universe was that big. Okay, so the way we measure brightness would be through something called the surface brightness, where we basically take the flux, that's like the observed power on some detector, divided by the angular scale on the sky. Okay, so the surface brightness is flux divided by angular scale. So the flux, that's the luminosity divided by 4 pi r squared, r is the distance to the object, right, for each star. And the surface brightness is, or sorry, the omega is just the area. So that's the area taken up by each one of these stars. And that's their area divided by the area of the sky. Yeah? So further away it is, the smaller it looks. But the important thing is that the observed angular scale of a star and the observed flux of the star both go like 1 over 4 pi r squared. So that cancels. So then the surface brightness is the luminosity, which we're saying is the same as the luminosity of the sun, because all these stars are just like the sun, divided by pi times the radius of the sun squared. And guess what? That's the surface brightness of the sun. Okay, so the implication is that if the universe was larger than 10 to the 17 megaparsecs, then the sky would be as bright as the sun everywhere on the sky, regardless of the fact that most of these stars are really far away, because there's a whole lot of them really far away. So, of course, that is not what we observe. So the implication of this is that if our universe is really homogeneous and isotropic, and remember, this scale is way, way bigger than the scale of homogeneity, which was 100 megaparsecs. So this, assuming that stars are homogeneously distributed, is a really, really good approximation on these distance scales. So if the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, basically it cannot be infinitely big. And by big, I really mean old, because light takes a finite amount of time to get to me. So if we want to make this assumption that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, then the fact that the night sky is dark implies that it cannot be infinitely old. So you can find proof for the Big Bang by just going outside and looking up at the sky. That's all you need. So we can do one more Twiddles estimate before moving on. We can talk about basically, okay, well, we can make a crude estimate of the age of the universe as follows. So first, how bright is the night sky actually? So the observed surface brightness, the average surface brightness of the night sky is 10 to the minus 17 watts per meter squared arc seconds squared. I did this on purpose so that I could explain to you and make sure you all know what an arc second is. So an arc minute is 1 degree divided by 60. An arc second is 1 arc minute divided by 60. Okay, so it's 1/360th of a degree. To quantify what these scales mean for astronomical objects, the moon is half a degree. I have it written down. Astronomy cheat sheet on the wiki, totally recommend it. Neptune is 1 arc second. So the angular scale of Neptune on the sky is 1 arc second, to give you an idea. So anyway, that's a very convenient unit to use in astronomy. Okay, so this is the flux, watts per meter squared, divided by the angular area, arc second squared. Okay, for reference, the surface brightness of the sun in the same units is 10 to the minus 3 watts per meter squared, arc second squared. Okay, so the night sky has a surface brightness that's like 10 to the 14 times smaller than the surface brightness of the sun. And that's basically all we need. Okay, so what we would like is that the probability to have a star along our line of sight is roughly the ratio of the observed surface brightness of the night sky to the surface brightness of the sun, because that's what it would have been if there was really a star along every line of sight. And that's like 10 to the minus 14. And this we're going to set equal to the number density times the volume of our pencil. And it's all for lambda. Okay, so lambda twiddles is 10 to the minus 14 times our previous result when the probability was 1. We can use that. And this is 10 to the 3 megaparsecs, or in other words, a gigaparsec. Okay? So if the stars were really uniformly distributed throughout the universe, and the universe was 1 gigaparsec big, then the surface brightness would be 10 to the 14 times smaller than surface brightness of the sun, than as if they were everywhere on the sky. OK, and then to get an age, we just take the speed of light times t naught and set it equal to a gigaparsec. Now, another convenient thing to remember, a parsec is 3 light years. So if we divide by c, then this in twiddles is like 3 giga years, right? 3 billion years. Yeah, it's a pretty good guess, actually. The real age of the universe is 14 billion years. So you kind of get it right. So you can even calculate the age of the universe by just looking up at the night sky to within 50% error, right? 100% error, it's even worse. But anyway, not bad. Okay, so important things to remember from what I just told you. Distance scales in the universe, kind of roughly the kinds of structures there are in the universe. Order of magnitude estimates, you could go home now and estimate all sorts of spherical cows that you want, like, I don't know, how many galaxies in the universe, or how far out do I have to look for there to be a galaxy within every certain part of the sky you can see? I don't know, lots of things you can do with these numbers. These are useful numbers to have just kind of floating around in your head. Okay, any questions about that part before we move on to talk about general relativity? Okay. So now I'll be in a bit of a tough spot, because I know many of you have taken courses on general relativity, and I know some of you have not. So I'm going to have to go back to the beginning and review GR. I'm not going to do this in a very pedantic way, but I'm rather going to do it from the perspective that as a cosmologist, you should have a working knowledge of general relativity, and be able to do practical things, but not necessarily understand how it's all derived. Okay, so I'm going to give you nothing of the why and wherefore, only the how. And then if you're interested in the why and wherefore, you will remember your course on general relativity that should be fresh in the heads of at least some of you. I know I just took it. Or otherwise, you'll have to take a course on general relativity. OK, so the language of cosmology is general relativity. So if you will, the next hour-ish of lecture will be the phrasebook of cosmology, not necessarily the French fourth year course that I flunked. True story, I took French 3 times. I flunked it 3 times. okay, so the language of cosmology is general relativity. The alphabet of general relativity are tensors. Okay, so the basic objects in GR are tensors. What are tensors? They are objects that describe some physical property. I'll leave that ambiguous of what? Of geometry, of matter, of something, okay? So it's just some physical thing that we want to describe in a coordinate independent way. Okay, so that's a tensor. Tensor is the alphabet. So what kinds of tensors are there? And how do they behave? Okay, so where we start is with vectors. So I have some vector B, and that vector can be described in terms of a set of components and a set of basis vectors. Of course, for those of you familiar with three vectors, which hopefully you all are, this would be the same as writing a vector, three vector in terms of components. We're just generalizing it. Okay, and the thing that makes a tensor was this statement that it describes a property of the physical system in a coordinate independent way. And so one of the most important things of a tensor is how it transforms under coordinate transformations, namely, doesn't. Okay, so we could take the components of a vector. And we can ask how the components of a vector transform under some linear operator called lambda that parameterizes an arbitrary coordinate transformation. Okay. So if the components of a vector transform as such. Then as long as the basis vectors transform like the inverse, and as long as there is an inverse, so namely that lambda mu nu prime, lambda nu prime rho, delta mu rho, in other words, the coordinate transformation times its inverse is the identity. Then if we plug this in to our definition of the vector, the thing that is invariant, then B will not transform. So you can plug that in and check it. It's a nice exercise. Okay. But this is the basic property of tensors, that their components, for this example, for vectors, their components and their basis vectors transform in the opposite way, such that the tensor itself remains invariant under coordinate transformations. that kind of defines a tensor. Okay, there's also dual vectors. So dual vectors you can think of as maps from the set of vectors to the real numbers. Check the time, okay, 10 minutes. So we could define a dual vector, which again, just like a vector, it's a tensor and it's an object, okay, as something that has a set of components times basis vectors, okay, where we define these basis vectors by how they act on the vector basis vectors. So this parentheses means x on. This is like an operator. So we define this dual basis vector by the fact that when it acts on a vector basis vector, it gives us the delta function. Okay, so then if that's true, we could think about how dual vectors act on vectors. So we've got the component, that's just a number. And then we've got the components of the vector, again, that's just a number. And then we have our dual basis vector, that was a mu. And that acts on our vector basis vector to give us a delta function. So we get this. So that's just, again, the repeated indices mean sum them. So we just take the components for each one of the values that these indices can take, multiply them together, and sum them up. Okay, if you like, that's kind of like dot product. That's not exactly right because we need the metric to define what we mean by a dot product, but it's the same kind of thing. Okay, so that's vectors and dual vectors, and then finally we can define a general tensor. So a KL tensor is a map from K dual vectors and L vectors to the real numbers. So we could define some tensor, we could call it T, and it would have components that would have sort of upstairs indices that go from 1 to k, and downstairs indices that go from nu 1 to nu l. So there would be k upper indices and l lower indices. And then we'd smush this together with the appropriate number of vector basis vectors times dual vector basis elements. Okay, and just like vectors and dual vectors, we care a lot about how they transform, and we know how they should transform because we know that these things transform in a particular way, and then this must transform in exactly the opposite way. Right? So in general, the transformation law for a KL tensor is just a whole string of these coordinate transformations one for each index. Times the original elements of the original components of that tensor. So super lightning review of what are tensors, but the important things to remember are just that they are objects, things like this piece of chalk that we describe in terms of components and basis elements, which transform under coordinate transformations in such a way that when I rotate a piece of chalk, it does not become an elephant. It stays a piece of chalk. Okay. All right. And in general relativity, there is a most important tensor, and that is the metric tensor. Okay, so G, I always get this wrong. It's got two lower indices, so we need two vectors, so it's a 0, 2 tensor in order to make a real number. It's a 0, 2 tensor. These are the components. And these are symbols we give for basis vectors. We can use a little bit of mathematical artistic license to call these things differentials, where we act on things that have the same name. I'll show you that in a second. But anyway, these can be interpreted, roughly speaking, as differentials. Okay, and then you can define an inverse metric. By requiring that if we took the metric and multiplied the components of the inverse metric by that, we should get a delta function. It's basically just the requirement that there's an inverse. Okay, so there's a metric and there's an inverse metric, and those are the two most important tensors in GR. And let me write down all the jobs that the metric does, and then we'll be done for today. Okay, so the metric does all the important jobs. It defines an inner product, so what we mean by a dot product. So if we act on two vectors, then we know that the result should be a real number. Okay, and so we get a real number, which is just the sum of this product of these components. It gives us the notion of a norm of a vector if I act the metric on two vectors. Then I'll get a number. That's the norm of this vector. It defines what you mean by orthogonality. So if you act G on two vectors and get zero, then those things are orthogonal. A few more jobs, and then we'll be done. So it maps vectors to dual vectors. In other words, it lowers indices. So if we act G on a vector V, then we're going to get G mu nu, G mu. We've got one basis element hanging out left over, and this just defines what we mean by v lower nu, a dual vector. We can also get vectors from dual vectors using the inverse metric. So if we act the inverse metric on some dual vector omega, then we have g upper mu nu acting on omega nu with one basis element left over. And this thing just tells us what we mean by omega upper mu. Okay, so it raises indices. It defines the invariant distance. So we define ds squared as if I actually take two differentials, then I just get back something that looks exactly like what we had before, but where these things mean different things. Okay. These are actually like distances between points now and not just abstract basis vector elements. And then finally, it defines the volume measure. So if I take an integral over all of the coordinates in an n-dimensional space, then I have to put a minus square root of the determinant of the metric in there to get the volume right. Okay? So the metric in GR does all these jobs. It is the most important tensor. And then next time, we will work with the metric. And we will get the working man or woman's knowledge of how to work with metrics and do useful stuff with them. Any questions before we stop for the day? Okie dokie. So see you Thursday then. Check out the wiki for some notes. And I'll email, you're going to give me your email address, Eli, and then those of you listening in remotely, I will email you with the notes right after class. Thanks a lot.